Welcome to Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Have you ever gone to a museum with ancient statues and just sort of wondered what it may look like, what the statues may look like if it wasn't missing an arm or a torso or even a head, never mind 75% of its body? If you're like me, you probably just assume, well, that's time and decay, and these things happen, an accident, and this is how these ancient statues become disfigured. But one thing I didn't think about until now is that they may very well be disfigured due to the rise of Christianity. That would very much resemble fundamentalism, very much resemble what we'd recognize today in the Islamic State. In fact, our guest today argues this very issue, that is through Christianity, the rise of Christianity, that would bring an end to the ancient world. Our guest is Catherine Nixie. Catherine Nixie is the author of the book, The Darkening Age, The Christian Destruction of the Classical World. She is a classicist and also a journalist. Catherine Nixie, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to our program.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for having me.
Just for context here, as we begin, how do you define the classical world?
Do you know, that's a good question, and that's basically what the whole of this book comes out of. Most people define the classical world as the fun bits when they were still wearing togas. So you kind of start in ancient Greece and you end when the emperors stop being mad and interesting. So you end somewhere around the end of the first century AD, and you start in around the 5th century BC. But you can stretch it way longer than that. You can say that the classical world began with Homer, which is 1,200 years or so BC, and you can take it all the way up to the generally agreed cutoff is where my book finishes, which is 529 AD.
And what's so significant about that last year?
When the Renaissance happened in Europe in the Middle Ages, when they looked back at this classical world that seemed so amazing and so ahead of its time, and that had come up with ideas like atomism, that had invented philosophy, that had invented drama, and they said, when did it stop? They picked the year 529, because that was when the academy in Athens, so we use the word academy a lot today, academy award, academy school, and it all comes from this single place in Athens, which is where Plato, the philosopher, used to teach. So every language, Académie in German, Académie, it's exactly the same in French. They all refer back to this school where Plato taught. And in 529 AD, the school that existed and called itself the Academy in Greece was shut down by the Emperor Justinian. And that, when the world looked back and said, when did the classical world end? They said it was then. It was when the Christian emperor shut that philosophical school because he was worried about what it would be teaching his Christian subjects.
Plato's academy lasted almost 1,000 years.
Yeah. I mean, they more or less, it was teaching pretty different stuff by the end of it than it was at the beginning. They'd become what we call Neoplatonism, which everyone gets very sniffy about and say that Plato would have been disgusted by it. And, you know, it did definitely veer into kind of what we would sort of describe as more magical almost stuff. But it also, they did a lot of science, they did a lot of experiments trying to work out what the notes of a musical scale were, what dyes were made of, and they taught an awful lot of maths and Plato and Aristotle.
We are going to come back to this story, but of course we're talking about the end of it right now. So again, the argument that you make in your book, The Darkening Age, The Christian Destruction of the Classical World, is very much that the rise of Christianity would lead, and the adoption of Christianity within the Roman Empire specifically would lead to the end of the classical world. So let's talk about the beginning of Christianity. And you tell this great story about, and this is in the second century, about a man by the name of Celsus. Am I saying his name correctly?
Oh, Celsus. Yeah, well, Celsus. I would say Celsus, but it doesn't, we all say everything wrong. So if Cicero heard any of us pronounce any Latin word, they'd be rolling on the floor. Yeah.
Tell me about who these two
Celsus
people are.
Celsus is so interesting. So I was brought up Catholic, and my mother had been a nun, my father had been a monk, and I thought I kind of knew this period. I when you start to read about it, you realize there was so much that was going on in the clash between the Christians and the Romans about which you had no idea. And a lot of what we've forgotten, because almost all of this encounter between Christianity and the Roman Empire has been told from entirely Christian sources, you forget what the Romans were saying about the Christians and the Greeks and the Romans. And when you look, astonishing. The kind of arguments that they were making then are the kind of arguments that people just started making maybe 100 years ago here. And this guy Celsus is one of the fiercest critics of Christianity. So he says he hates it, for a start, that he absolutely loathes it. And he attacks every bit of it. He goes through the Old Testament and the New Testament attacking it. And it's astonishing to read it now, because it feels like the kind of philosophical criticism that would even now set people back on their heels a bit. So he says things like, when he talks about the Old Testament, he describes it as utter trash. And he picks it apart bit by bit. So he takes things like the story of creation. And he says, like, this is crazy, this story of creation. You know, he's an omnipotent God. Why did it take him 7 days to make the world? If he's so omnipotent, why wouldn't he just make it in one day? Boom. Why did he, like, and he says, like a bad builder, lay out his work bit by bit, doing so much on a Monday, so much on a Tuesday. And then, and this feels so Roman to me, and like a bad builder, he had a rest on the Sunday.
Now, we only know of Celsus through the writings of another ancient writer, an ancient Christian writer who was refuting Celsus, and his name is Origen.
Exactly. So when we think of the Christians in the ancient world, we think of them as being these amazing scholarly preservers of texts. You know, we think of monks in their copying houses and things like that. And later, yeah, that's true, they did. What we have from the classical world is largely preserved by Christians. But that doesn't mean that they preserved everything from the classical world. In fact, 99% of Latin texts were lost after Christians came to power because they hated them. And when you read them, you can see why they hated them. Not only are they full of gods who Christians say you can't worship, they're also full of sex and rudeness, what Christians would have seen as rudeness, and homosexuality and drunkenness and debauchery. But worst of all, they're full of philosophy, and they're full of philosophy that attacks gods, not just the Christian God, lots of gods. They were always doubting, always questioning the Greeks and the Romans. And one of the people who is almost lost is this philosopher Celsus. He survives on the slenderest thread, and he survives only in a Christian text by a man named Origen. And Origen didn't mean to preserve him. He meant to kind of destroy him. I hated what Celsus had said, and he attacked him line by line. So it's almost like a drama. So Celsus says something, and then you get about 8 lines of Origen underneath saying it's rubbish. But in doing this, and because it was a Christian text, Origen preserves Celsus for us. It's like a tree that preserves an insect in amber, and you can get the insect out of the amber that was supposed to kill it eventually. And that's what we have with Celsus. So Celsus should have all been destroyed. Origen meant to, like, destroy his arguments, but actually he saved them. And when you look at them, you can see why the Christians hated them, because they are powerful, powerful arguments.
Here in the United States, we still have a debate over creationism, which is interesting, and how interesting it actually in some ways mirrors the debate that was happening in the classical world. It was this debate between Epicureanism and creationism. And it's through this philosopher Epicurus where we get this the notion of an atom, and that that the reality is based on these things called atoms.
Yeah, exactly. So Epicureans, now when we say Epicurean today, I imagine it's the same in America. You mean someone who's almost disgustingly greedy. They eat and they drink till they're sick. They're, you know, fine livers. Now, Epicureanism in the ancient world was nothing like that. The Christians slurred them terribly because they hated the powerful arguments that they made against Christianity. And they dismissed them as drunkards and greedy, high livers. But actually, what the Epicureans were these people who said, there are no gods, we're all made of atoms, and there's no such thing as creation by a god. The world is just full of atoms coming together and moving apart. And when you die, your atoms will just move away. They'll just go into the great space of the world, and you'll be kind of reconstituted within the universe. But I mean, they don't really go into that. They just say, there's no God. We're just atoms. We're atoms and stuff. And they have this proto-Darwinian kind of argument for how animals came about and came to be different. They say, well, you know, the fox is really cunning, so it survived. And the dog is really fast, so it survived. And every animal has a trait that helps it exist. And to Christians, this is terrifying stuff. You know, there's no Christian God and there's no creation and there's no heaven and hell, then why would anyone believe in Christianity? And so they go for these sort of arguments, they attack them, and they celebrate that these doctrines are being lost in their own time. St. Augustine celebrates that nobody knows Epicurus anymore, or nobody knows the ancient philosophers anymore.
And it's really interesting to me because, as you point out, the reason why we even have works still, in large part, is because of Christianity, Christian monks. That said, the Christians still destroyed the vast majority of material that now we don't have access to. And just as I was reading your book, The Darkening Age, I was like, well, here, you talked about Deuteronomy in the Bible. And I was like, well, let me pull out my Bible. And here's the King James Version of the Bible, which, of course, is not around during this period. But I wanted to read from Deuteronomy 7:5, quote, and you led me here, but it says this, quote, "But thus shall ye deal with them," talking about the pagans. "Ye shall destroy their altars, break down their images, and cut down their groves, and burn their graven images with fire." That really, you write about in a statue of Athena. Now, Athena is this very important god in Greek mythology, in ancient Greek religion. The name, the city in Greece, Athens, comes from this god. And you write about a statue of Athena that was destroyed with the rise of Christianity, actually put back together, restored somehow, but again destroyed just a few years ago by the Islamic State.
Yeah. I know, it's extraordinary. I mean, had it not been so tragic, I would have sort of laughed at the coincidence of it almost. So my book opens with an attack on a temple in Palmyra that happened in probably 385 AD, which is just when Christianity was really gaining power. It was really starting to take over the empire, and it was really starting to crack down on all other religions. You know, they'd been chaining shut temples. Soon they would pass laws that said that anyone who went into them would be cut down with a sword. And they started to encourage the destruction of temples because they thought, you know, if there are no temples, then people can't go in and worship these idols. They called them idols. And in this period, you had bands of black-robed, the writer describes them, stinking black-robed bearded monks who go about the countryside like a river in spate. And whenever they find a pagan statue or a pagan temple, they attack it with sticks and stones and iron bars and their hands and feet if necessary. And they just destroy them. You know, they went through Syria, suffered the worst destruction, but it went, you know, all the way across the Roman Empire, up to Bath in England and down to Egypt. And they smashed up what they saw, these things, what they called idols. And they went into that temple in Palmyra and they found a beautiful statue of Athena. And the men came up to her. We assume they're men, they're almost always men in all the accounts we have. They came up to her with a sword and hit her on the back of the head so hard that her head was decapitated. And then they took their sword and then they chopped her arms off. And then they pushed the statue's body face forward into the dirt. And then they smashed the head again. So she had three blows in all on her head. And then the temple was deserted. It was left. Now, over the centuries, it became covered with dirt. And then in the 80s, a Polish archaeologist found it, uncovered this statue, took pictures of her lying face down in the dirt. You see them in the paper. It looks almost like a crime scene with this body lying on the floor. And then they reassembled it. So they put it back together. So her head was put on her torso, her arms were reassembled. And then ISIS came. So then in 2015, exactly the same thing happened to her again. An American newspaper, I think it was the Washington Post, released pictures showing what had happened to Palmyra after ISIS had been there. And the statue of Athena was there, and exactly the same injuries had happened to her.
I am a big fan of museums. I enjoy going to museums. I, in fact, enjoy very much going to the museum in your country, the British Museum, and I'm very aware of all the controversies over it, including of Greek artifacts. But that all said, you look at statues from the ancient world, and they're always missing a hand or missing a head or missing a leg or missing something, usually, a vast majority of these statues. And I never really thought a lot about it. I just thought, well, you know, it's probably gravity and just time, but it might be much more than just that.
Exactly, yeah. So some of it is gravity and just time. Statues are fragile and it knock them over and they go. But a lot of them suffered very violent attacks from Christians who thought that they were idolatrous demons. So they thought demons dwelt in them, and they thought that they were the possessions of idol worshippers. And so they used to smash them up. So they would chop their noses off. They'd chop their arms off. They'd attack their breasts if they're women, because they didn't like anything too sexual. And they'd smash them. And you see this, as you mentioned, in the British Museum. So there are two quite famous statues in there. One is the Parthenon marbles, and another is a statue of Germanicus. And both have been attacked viciously by Christians. So the Parthenon marbles are missing faces, missing hands, missing feet. And when they do have faces, often they're quite badly mauled. And normally, you assume, everyone assumes, that this was just time, or this was just probably Elgin's clumsy workman.
And that's Lord actually, Elgin, who took a lot of this material.
Yes, yeah, sorry. Yeah, England, yeah, yeah. Elgin. Look, yeah.
Lord and
Elgin,
he's not a very popular guy in Greece.
No. No, he's not. And there's quite a few people in England who dislike him as well. But I think the British Museum are probably not going to budge. But anyway, so he was the guy who brought them from Greece to England. Now, so these statues are in a terrible way, a lot of them. But it wasn't time, and it wasn't Elgin. It was Christians, most likely, attacking them because they thought they were demonic. And I went round the Parthenon marbles with he's called the Head of Greece and Rome. If you work in the British Museum, you get amazing titles. So I went round with the Head of Greece and Rome, and I said, look, is it possible that these statues just sort of lost their heads accidentally? And he said, you don't get your head knocked off accidentally if you're 50 feet up in the air.
You write that many of the saints that we venerate today, saints like St. Augustine, Benedict, St. Anthony, that these people got their start by actually destroying pagan altars and statues.
Yeah, and Augustine was emphatic that this is what God wants. I mean, he takes it for granted that his congregation, when they're not sitting listening to him, will be out smashing up pagan temples. He said that all pagan objects of paganism should be destroyed is what God wants, what God desires, what God wills. Saint Benedict smashed up a shrine. And, you know, it was absolutely normal and standard behavior, because to Jerome, to Augustine, these things were the work of demons. They were idols. They were wicked. And until really quite late, you have lovely pictures of saints. There's a wonderful one of, I think it's Saint Apollonia, ascending in this nice pink dress with a hammer in her hand to smash up a statue of, I think, some pagan statue. You know, it's celebrated. This is what you should be doing. You should be smashing statues. If you find yourself in Palmyra, it's the work of a good, dutiful Christian to go and smash up a statue. And the law encourages you to do it. And even if you go a bit beyond the law and get a bit carried away, then, you know, as one Christian said, well, there is no crime for those who have Christ. Just do it anyway. It's God's law that matters, not the law of the land.
We are speaking to Catherine Nixey. She is the author of the book, The Darkening Age, The Christian Destruction of the Classical World. Can you tell me about the Egyptian city of Alexandria, the importance of this city in the classical world, and also perhaps about what we, I think, will recognize today in popular vernacular, the library of Alexandria?
It was an amazing city, Alexandria. It was one of about 18 cities that Alexander the Great founded and then named after himself. Nobody's ever accused him of being modest. But this was the sort of jewel in the crown. It was beautiful white marble. A lovely breeze came up from the Mediterranean all the time. And so intellectuals from everywhere flooded from the empire. Intellectuals from all across the empire used to come there and study. So the guy who first suggested that the earth goes around the sun studied there. Archimedes studied there. Galen studied there. And it was a town that was obsessed by books. It had all these brilliant men, and it would take what they wrote, and then it would store it in the Great Library of Alexandria, which was said at its peak to have about 500,000 scrolls. It was easily the biggest library the world had ever seen, and it was the biggest one it would ever see for another probably 1,000, well over a millennium. It was a city that absolutely venerated the intellectual. Now, it was also a city that had one of the most beautiful temples in the world. And in 390, and we've not really heard of this temple today, because when we think of beautiful ancient temples, we tend to think of the Pantheon in Rome or the Parthenon in Athens. We don't really think of ones in Alexandria. But writers of this period, they were obsessed by one temple in particular. So when they write about what the most beautiful buildings in the world are, they don't mention the Pantheon. They don't talk about the Parthenon. What they all talk about is this one temple in Alexandria, and they called it the Serapeum, temple to Serapis. It was said to be the first thing you'd see as you sailed into Alexandria on 100 glittering white marble steps with statues inside it that were so brilliant and so lifelike, they looked like they might draw a breath at any minute. And with gold that was on its walls, and most crucially of all, it had another kind of wealth. It had the intellectual wealth of the Great Library of Alexandria was stored in it. Now,
it's also
really
a Greco-Egyptian god, right? I mean, it's sort of a homage in some ways, I would say, to multiculturalism, maybe.
It was. The library was obsessive in collecting everything from every religion. So Alexander the Great felt that you couldn't really control the people unless you understood what they believed. So from the beginning, the library was obsessive in trying to get the sacred texts, if religion had them, of all other religions. So it would try and get Zoroastrianism. It would try and get anything that it could from its own Greco-Roman religion. And it was here, they say, that the first translation of the Bible in the Old Testament into Greek was made. We call it the Septuagint today because it had 70 scholars, and that it was the Library of Alexandria that made that translation.
This is an important place, Alexandria, in the development of Christianity because of its intellectual tradition.
Yeah, because of its intellectual tradition. And some of the most important thinkers in this period are going to come from here, and they're going to be here. It's an absolute melting pot. You know, when you look at sort of shipping routes of the ancient world, they come into here, they go out of here. It supplied Rome with grain. You know, it was one of the empires, if not, you know, it was if not the second, it was probably the second city of the empire, and hugely, hugely important in every way. And one of the most important things in it was this beautiful, beautiful temple of Serapis. But we never hear of it today. And the reason we never hear of it is because in 392 AD, a mob of Christians led by a local Christian bishop went up its steps and tore it apart. They smashed the statues. They ripped the gold from the walls. They pulled down the columns, and they took the great statue of the god that had been in the middle, smashed it, and then dragged it to a stadium nearby and burnt it in front of everyone, because again, it was an idol. And in the course of that destruction, the last of the Great Library of Alexandria was gone, scattered to the winds, as is the way that one writer puts it.
Tell me the story of Hypatia.
So the Alexandria hadn't seen the end of Christian and pagan fighting yet. So a few years after that happened, in 415 AD, a woman named Hypatia was walking along when she was stopped by some Christians. Now, Hypatia, you might have heard of her. People might have seen the film Agora with Rachel Weisz. She was a mathematician and a philosopher, and she was absolutely brilliant. We commonly describe her as a philosopher, but it was her maths that was really better, and her astronomy. She redesigned the astrolabe. And she worked at preserving her father's work, and her father himself had worked at preserving and ordering the works of Euclid, the mathematician. So until the 1950s, if you were studying Euclid in school, you would have pretty much been studying it as Hypatia's father had preserved it. So these were some of Alexandria's greatest minds, she and her father. But the Christians in Alexandria, who were much less likely to be educated than the non-Christians, and who were much more likely to be suspicious of an educated woman as she was, they saw her using her astrolabes, and they saw her giving her lectures on mathematics with those symbols, and they said that she wasn't doing maths and she wasn't doing astronomy. They said that what she was doing was she was doing the work of the devil. So the astrolabe was an instrument of Satan, and the symbols were the words of the underworld. They were the words of demons. They were demonic writings. And they said that she's casting spells over Alexandria with these. They said that she was atheizing, is the word they use. She's turning the people of Alexandria against the Christian God. And so in 415 AD, Hypatia was going out on her chariot for her customary ride around the city. and she was stopped by this band of Christians, led by a man called Peter, who we're told was in all respects a perfect believer in Jesus Christ. And Peter took her, they dragged her from her chariot, and they took pieces of broken pot, and they flayed her alive. And some say that while she still gasped for breath, they gouged out her eyes. And then they took her dismembered limbs, and they burnt her, and then chucked her into a rubbish dump.
During this period of time, the destruction of the library, what happens to Hypatia, there's another figure. And this figure I really find fascinating, and I'm not a historian. I like to tell people I'm a history enthusiast. And if you go to the original word enthusiasm, that actually means fanatic, so it could be a problem. but you know, I've done a lot of study in the last year or two of the ancient world, even went to Athens, and I did a lot of study about Athens because I was interested in, you know, one of the first democracies that we have documented. And even throughout my past year of trying to really study this, I never heard of this figure until I opened up your book, and that's Damasius. And Damasius would be the last Platonic scholar in Athens before the academy is shut down. But before that, he's actually in Alexandria when all of this is going, and he has to flee.
He's such a likable man, Damasius. He's a philosopher and a mathematician. Again, that all philosophers were really mathematicians as well in this period. And he's also a very catty writer. So he spends a lot of time when he should probably be writing about about philosophy, being nasty about his fellow philosophers and putting down some fun gossip. But he is in Alexandria at this period, and he sees what's going on, and he hates it. So he describes, he and his fellow philosophers, he says, we are being swept away by the torrent. I mean, there's often an argument that people in the Roman Empire were pleased to see a Roman emperor become Christian, because once the Roman emperor was Christian, everyone was free. We could all, you know, everyone could come out of hiding. All those poor persecuted Christians should come out. It was absolute rubbish, because when the first emperor became Christian, less than 10% of the empire was Christian. 90% were happily worshipping other gods or no gods at all. And they weren't happy to see this sudden turn in the empire's direction. And when you read works like Damasius, you sense it. You sense an absolute horror at the oppression that's starting to fall on people like them. I mean, not everyone. Of course, lots of people were happy to become Christian, and lots of people, you know, muddled along in a sort of mixture of religions. But those who really saw what was going on were appalled, and Damasius is one of them. So he is a philosopher in Alexandria, and you can tell from Hypatia what happened to someone else, but lots of philosophers have a pretty tough time. So Damasius's brother is hung up by the wrists and flogged because the Christian authorities want to find out where the other philosophers are hiding. They all have to go into hiding at one point, the philosophers, because there's a sort of local official has come to the area, and they're trying to find out where they all are and make them convert, and or more just sort of attack them for being the philosophers they are. And Damasius in the end decides that he just can't live as a philosopher and a non-Christian in Alexandria anymore. And so he jumps in a boat and he sails away to Athens. And when he's in Athens, that's when he starts to get going the academy again. So the academy traces its history back over 1,000 years in what it calls this golden chain to Plato. I mean, as I touched on earlier, I think Plato would have something to say about the way that that golden chain went in its latter years. But, you know, they are still studying Plato. They are still studying Aristotle. They are still positing ideas that Christians don't like. And that's the really dangerous thing that they do. They contradict Christianity. And in this period, Christianity starts to lose patience with this. So Damasius flees to Athens. He's a bit after Hypatia, and he starts to set up the academy, and he tries to keep philosophy going in Athens. He's failed in Alexandria. It's become too dangerous. So he tries it there, but he's too successful for his own good is his problem. Man, he's hugely energetic, and he gets going.
Let me just stop you for a second, because my apologies. You said hugely successful in Athens, and then you cut out. So I just wanted to allow you to go back to that part if you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was hugely successful in Athens, like way too successful for his own good. And the Christian authorities start to notice that people are again coming from all over the empire to study there, like they would have done, exactly as they would have done in the time of Plato, and exactly as they did to Alexandria a few, some years before. And they are annoyed by this because the emperor is now Justinian. And Justinian is obsessively Christian. So his declaration is that he wants to close all the roads that lead to error. Nobody now is going to be allowed to take part in what he sees as the sinful, the wicked, the insane rites, they call them, of paganism. The words in the law of the law in this period are almost hysterical with loathing at all religions other than Christianity. And so what Justinian says is that nobody is going to be allowed anymore to teach doctrine that contradicts Christianity. And so that is going to hit Damascius, who teaches just that directly. And so the academy, not long after that law is passed, closes. But more than that, you know, Damascius doesn't want to stay in Europe anymore. Europe was the birthplace of philosophy. But you can hardly be a philosopher there anymore because you have to convert to Christianity. And if you don't convert, then you'll lose all your possessions. And if you convert and then still don't really believe, then you risk execution. And so he and seven other philosophers just decide to leave. They pack their bags and they go. And it's this extraordinary symbolic moment that when the last philosophers of the academy in Athens decide that Europe is no longer a place for philosophers because Christianity will not let them think freely. And that is the moment when people looking back afterwards said, yes, that is when the Dark Ages begin.
Damascius is an old man at this time, I think around 70 years of age, if I recall correctly. Where does he go?
They go east. They go east to Persia. They've heard that Persia is a place that will welcome philosophers. And they, in the end, they don't find it to their taste. So they find out that they do things like they don't bury their bodies. They have them out on the ground and they're pecked by birds. And this appalls the Athenians. There's nothing worse that can happen to you than having your body pecked by birds. It's the first lines of the Iliad are sing goddess of the anger of Achilles that threw down to Hades so many souls and left that remainder as food carrion to be plucked up by birds. It's a big disgrace. So they go to this country and they think it's going to be perfect and it isn't perfect. I mean, you know, philosophers should know better that the grass is not going to be greener. But in some ways it is, you know, that they are welcomed by the king, King Khosrow. But it's, you know, it isn't the perfect land they hope for. They hope to find Plato's philosopher king ruling and they don't. And in the end, they just disperse and, you know, more with a whimper than with a bang, classical philosophy just sort of peters out. You have a letter from here, a poem, an epigram from there that you think might belong to Damascius, and that's it. And then it's just gone.
Before we began our conversation, you told me, as I indicated to you earlier, before we even began again to do this for radio, that I never heard of Damascius before I opened your book. And you told me something interesting, that he's very well known by theologians, but not classicists.
Mm. So the whole period I write about isn't that well known outside classics, and it's not even that well known within it. And somebody described it once. They said it's basically, it falls between the typewriters of the theologians and the classicists. So the classicists basically lose interest when Christianity comes along because that's not their beef. That belongs to the theologians. And the theologians aren't that interested in this period because, you know, they're interested when Christianity kicks off and to them, you know, to a theologian, it was always going to succeed. You know, you read lots and lots of lines in books that are written from the assumption that Christianity would always win. It's very hard for us today to imagine a world in which Christianity didn't win out. So this betwixt and between period where the tide is flowing one way, then flowing the other, and where people are fighting back against, pushing back against Christianity, but Christianity is pushing back much harder against them. I mean, that doesn't really fall into any subject area. So it kind of gets missed out. And I mean, I said it earlier, but almost all writing about this period until very, very recently was told solely on the basis of Christian sources. Nobody was interested in what the Romans or the Greek philosophers or writers might have been saying in this period. And what they were saying was this the ones who really cared was a terrible cry of horror. There's a wonderful, one of my favorite quotes that I came across when I was doing this book was from a man named Symmachus, who, when the Christians were trying to take away one of the oldest and most famous altars in Rome, and he wrote a letter, he wrote a plea to the emperor, and he said, "Please, we see the same stars, the same sky is shared by all. What does it matter what route a person uses to seek the truth?" And it, anyway, mattered to the Christians because they took the altar away and he lost.
Finally, Catherine Nixie, if not all, though I guess we also have archaeology, so that's a different story, but most of the material that we have from the classical world is still here with us today because of Christian and Christian monks. Is there a reason why some works survived and others did not?
Yeah, definitely. We don't have any works of atomist works suffered worse, and works that directly attack Christianity, as well as Celsus. There was an even more powerful attack by another philosopher that we just completely lost. It was something like 17 books long, and that completely went because it was so hated that Constantine himself seems to have stepped in. We can sort of assume this. He was called Porphyry, this philosopher. And he knew his Christianity inside out, and he criticized it punishingly. You know, he said things like, he didn't believe the story of Jonah in the whale. He thought that was absolute rubbish that a man would survive inside a fish for so long. And he said things like, "If only those who have Christ are saved, why did God wait so long to send him? Did he forget? Did he, you know, not care before?" And so some writers were differentially targeted. And there's evidence as well that palimpsests are where, to reuse parchment, you would write over one thing with another. You'd wash off the old stuff and write over it with a new document. And there's evidence that Christian monks seem to have, so say there was a very rude classical text, they would wash that off and then write over it with a Christian text on chastity, say. So it was almost like a war of words was being conducted through documents and through words that, but the war of words was that one word would just wash away the other one.
Catherine Nixie has been our guest. Again, she is the author of the book, The Darkening Age, The Christian Destruction of the Classical World. Catherine Nixie, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you greatly.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.